Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
podcast while walking, progress, technical progress in making knowledge cubes. Now, I suppose I have to give you a bit of a background of it. So a knowledge cube is a clear plastic box. And inside it, you can connect it up to power. It can have its power itself. And inside it is a little bit of a robot controller, a little bit of doodads, and essentially it does all the teaching for you. So it takes a complex subject, which would be beyond the ability of the average teacher to assemble, and it's just a basic cube they can take out. And a friend of mine, Professor John Canning, who saw it, said, "Oh, look, it's like Orac of Blake 7. So Blake 7 is a late 70s, early 80s BBC rip-off of Star Wars. I sort of added it with a bit more intense soap opera writing. And in the middle of it, they had stolen a ship, which was made out of kitchen utensils, you know, put through some really dodgy acceptable video editing, and there was this adventure of this Blake against the Galactic Federation. So you had the standard sort of Star Wars plot going, and in the centre would be this see-through cube, and you could see through it. You could see the electronics for it, and so it was a bit more interesting. And that was called Orac of Oracle. So these cubes are about that size, and inside it there's little bits of Arduino boards and programming. And so I can take something which I can build, which is beyond the level of teachers, and put it in. And today's marked a watershed where I've finally cracked through and finished off one and broken through onto another. So I should just basically describe it. So one of the basic things one has in quantum mechanics that one wants to teach is the concept of spin. And spin is a whole new dimension. You've got X, Y, Z, and you've actually got a new spin dimension. And that spin dimension means that we are living in a superposition of two universes, spin up and spin down, and they're related by they're related by an angular momentum, a unit of angular momentum between the two of them. And you can't actually move between the two. They're an object in spin up will actually move through another object and spin down. And there's all this advanced geometry. So your electron, for instance, your fundamental building block of chemistry, and your understanding actually has 720 degrees symmetry, and it actually pulls through itself to change its direction of spin. Unlike a top, which can actually precess and move around, an electron can't vary the direction of its spin. It can only flip its spin, but flipping it, it's really like punching it through. So all that sort of stuff. And one of the things to do is to use this property, the way that spin is linked to angular momentum, now I really hope my directional microphone is working here and that I'm not actually overawed by wind and all this type of stuff tonight. However, so if you get a ceramic and place it in an alternating magnetic field and get it to go at the right frequency, it will begin to shake. And basically, as I've tracked it down, I've sort of moved in with Arduino parts and power supplies and bits and pieces of Chinese toys, ordered them in, bits and pieces of an old robot laboratory which I've had to decommission bits and pieces like that, and put it in one of these cubes which I've built up. And the great thing about it is that the laser goes through, hits the ceramic, bounces off. As the ceramic oscillates, it throws the laser beam in this this pattern. And I haven't fully worked out, there's some very fine things you can see now in the pattern. I still haven't quite worked it out, and I still find it hard to believe. And in my because this is an incredibly fun effect, but I've just built a relatively robust high Q oscillator and a high strength field, and used electronics for it. So where this is taken, it's taken I got up to a point and overpowered it, and eventually melted my coils, running at high power for 24 hours. And so I've just used the Arduino to run it for 10 minutes, and it shuts itself down. And the thing that really is necessary is to people keeps people's attention is to if it's oscillating, people really don't necessarily get it. So I had to get a $3 LCD screen, which is parallel port, and it's sort of, it's hard to say. It was the cheapest at the time, and it requires 8 wires in to, because it requires not a byte of data, a nibble of data, half a byte of data, and two controls, one to clock in the information, another to say whether it's a computer command or a actual data command, and then your ground and power. And so that took an awful lot, so I got it up working relatively quickly, and then as I wanted to remove it, I must have overheated it. It's very hard to diagnose and pull it off. Now, one of the things that I now do realize is that these components, as they get more and more sophisticated, actually, in some instances, have little computers on them. And that's why they can get quite expensive, because they've actually got really basically little computers on it. And so you're actually hooking up computers to computers. And, of course, it means that it's not a passive component. It actually, if you stuff it around, if you get it wrong, you're not going to get anything sensible on it. And I wasn't getting anything sensible on one board. And so I had this long time waiting for the replacement coils, and then another long time to get a replacement board. Then I put it in and had a construction. I could bring it in and interested in the university and to show people. But it's a really interesting thing that when I first said, look, I'm going to go in these high value targets and see if I can get them, partly because it'll extend the therapy for me, and partly because if I do succeed, it's worthwhile. And interestingly, people live in a world where that's not so, and so I haven't got much response from Sydney University on it. And so I got this up, and it doesn't sound much of a drama, but essentially basically hours of work over today and yesterday to just link up, just to hook up these this display. And so this display says the period to so many or microseconds, as it's done, six figures of precision on microseconds. It's got a period of 81 milliseconds oscillation, and then it's got the reciprocal of that and writes it in frequency. So you can see the frequency and the period written against each other. And of course, as it one of the things that I've done is that initially one of the things is that you could flick one of these oscillators and film the laser running back and forth, get its resonance frequency, and then program your Arduino into it. Now, what it means that as it's gone very high Q, what I've had to do is actually do a chirped scan, start at a low frequency and slowly go up to high frequency, and as it goes over the resonance, it suddenly goes through a large amount, and essentially when it's operation, I start off either side of the resonance and just scan it through for about 10 minutes. And of course, it's doing this, the size of the pattern is changing, because one of the things that you do have with students is that if nothing changes, there's nothing to observe, there's nothing to think about. So I have it as the Arduino board is pumping it out. The Arduino board is commanding a robot board, which commands the magnetic field. And as it does that, it reports it to the LED screen, and that was just a real nightmare. And it's one of these things that you're very much aware that your cognitive ability isn't there. You're sort of I'm using a micro USB cabling because that's robust. So there's one of these things that you learn from robotics is that if you get the cabling right, everything else fails. Everything else works from there. So I've got the cabling, and I had to actually reverse it, and then I had it on the outside of the package and realized that my conception of these boxes where you could plug in display units and stuff like that is just too hard for teachers. So if you had a teacher and you said, well, here's your box and you've got to plug in a display unit, that would be too hard for it. So I rotated the USB ports internally and hooked it up internally, and good hour or so hour doing that, and sort of there's a limit to how much podcasting I could do during the day. The reason for that is that I was picking up my mother-in-law and all this type of stuff, and so essentially when I put it together, that phase, the magic cube for the Einstein de Haas. So this is a key quantum mechanics experiment. So strategically, the idea is that if you're not given access to teaching, you can sort of go out and build these advanced science things, and you know, like nothing else is going to work. But if that works, that's at least a path forward. So that's sort of concluded this, and I packed it up and took it up to my friend's house, Pino, and he's got shift work, and I described to his wife how you just put it in the cube, she put it on a dresser, plug it in, and if you plug it in, switch it on, it works, and everything is there. So at least it's got that far. And so that's the really much the end of the Einstein de Haas. And then I had to look at the next teaching cube. So the next teaching cube, so this is, you think of the major things holding back education in sort of science, and the fundamental problem with teaching science is that we're not teaching science, we're teaching something else. We're teaching something which is easy to teach, but it's not science. It's easy to teach that the electrons are like this, and it's easy to teach that this effect, which is inside this cube, can't happen. Okay, it's easy to do. However, it does happen, and all modern science is based on quantum mechanics. So that's the overall philosophy for it. Then, sort of looking at the way that chemistry is taught, it's taught like as this really extended, boring soap opera where you look at one character at a time. Do you spend a whole season looking at one character and then go over to the other? And the aim is to have one of these boxes, which I've built, and it has load sensors, temperature sensors. I still have to really chew through the pH sensor, because it just doesn't fit in where I want it. So I think I might do the famous IC2 process. So I've got this box, and I've got some old tiles, kitchen tile. They're chipped on the side, but I've sort of glued them down and put the three load cells and the temperature sensors there. And it turns out, like all of this stuff, I'm much slower than it's sort of like pretty much, but it's the same deal, that there is this technological hurdle that no one has got through, and I'm throwing myself at it, and it's just sort of coming to the realization that there's no one there to help you. And if you fall on your face, you fall on your face. What happens? You stay on your face for a while and you pick yourself up. So in this, I had the idea is that this little box has a mobile phone battery in it. It's got all the wireless in it, and it charges off there, and it then connects to the internet. And so one of my absolute strong point is building robust data and component systems where the actual activity is dispersed. And so this is absolutely vital, that the data gets onto the internet. And I've finally crashed through there, and so on this I'll just do a few more loops and just describe where we're up to. So finally there is a web page, and the web page is glenbrookinstitute.org/test, subdirectory test, T-E-S-T, /c.html. So c.html is a refreshing page for b.html, and b.html is just where the data is written to, and a.php is the so you can have two web pages. You can have a web page which goes in a browser, which is HTML, or you can have a PHP, which is a web page. It's a page on the web, but essentially it's got commands that when the server is holding it, it is looking at the web, looking at the page, and it's ready to do some basic commands. And so for this, it runs with some information, takes the information out, constructs it, puts a date stamp on it, and publishes it from A to B, B to C. And so you can log into c.html. You could possibly, if you wanted to, look at b.html. b.html doesn't update. c.html does update every second, but you know, it's got this nightmare thing. If you want to look at it, it blinks and refreshes, and you know, it's just, you know, huge streams of raw data, which is the so as I speak, this little box is you know, my wife said, you're going out for a walk, turn off the computer. I don't want the computer on because I've had to move the computer into our bedroom because of the study construction area my mother-in-law's moved into. But this little computer, you put it on not the computer, you put the little box, magic box, on the shelf, and underneath it are the little lights glowing saying, I'm on battery power and I'm speaking to the internet. It's every time, every quarter of a second it blinks, or every half second I suppose it blinks, saying I'm putting more data to the internet. And so what was the big issue? With all these things, it's having no support whatsoever coming out. And you get a sort of a sense of support, but then this feeling that, oh no, you're just going to be left to it. And I have this thing where I could literally do in a code to write to a PHP file. So, and then there's a sort of reasons why I want to write high-level data to an internet server and just leave it like that, whereas people love having a web page which can be interrogated. So your chip has a web page which you can, a URL which you can interrogate and read the information off. That's not perhaps what I want to do. I want to have the opposite thing, that your chips, your little experiment is just chundering out. Chundra means the Australian word for vomit. It's just chucking out the data, and it's this is putting out at this moment 5 bits of data every half second, tick tock. As it does it, it puts out 3 load cells, 3 for the 3 feet of a tripod, a temperature sensor, and the temperature of the chip inside. It's just putting it out, and I couldn't work out why it wasn't working. And was it that the code I'd written is incorrect? Was it that the server was rejecting it? There was something set that the server was rejecting it, or was there something else? And you've got an internet of things writing to your web page. It's pretty scary stuff. It's almost like, it's a very naked thing to do. It doesn't have to do any sort of authentication. It just sort of like plops information. There's no there's potential for, I suppose, for like any denial of service PHP, someone can get onto it and absolutely cram it. And so PHP is a program run on your server, and I suppose if you're not careful, any sort of hacker can just send heaps of requests and shut things down. So hopefully the people in America will do it. So the big issue was trying to find out, and there was a couple of things of moving the variable. These variables were produced later on in the program, and they had to go back up to a function which was called, write the data to the internet, something like that. And firstly, it just wouldn't do it. It would do it for sort of crazy stuff I wrote, but it wouldn't do it for this ensemble of data. And so eventually I had to learn how to declare global variables. But even when I did declare global variables, it didn't like it. And then I modified it so that it could shift up the functions, my understanding of C++, and all of this you really don't need to know if you've got LabVIEW. It's all sort of just very intuitive, but you've had to go back. And so the function is void, the name of the function, and then a in brackets. Now if you then say what I have to return, you can say integer rather than void. Void says it's not returning anything, so that's why the word void's there. Then in brackets, you then declare your variables that you're going to put in, or type of variables, and then when you call the function, you can actually pop those variables in. So that's what I wound up doing. I wound up popping in the text variables, and I think I took my kids to Scouts, and I thought, oh, what it has to be, it's objecting. So when I put certain things, certain simple things in, it doesn't object, but the server just says, no, look, I'm not doing it. And then, of course, looking at it, server was taking a... So the server is the internet computer. You know, you have a service provider, and they provide computers which you rent and put your internet site on. And so what it turned out that I just tried it out, and it just couldn't take a space. So I replaced all the spaces with underscores. Rather than writing this complex stuff, because I know where I'm going, rather than writing complex stuff where it sends a whole series of PHP requests, and for each data thing, and it takes it across there and it's done the page, I just string it all together in a single string and just send in one string across. And that string, then in the a.php, I add the date, the time date, which is in PHP, to put in the date on the server is just the date in brackets, the syntax of what it is, and that's a thing. And if you want to add things together in PHP, in HTML, you have to do a plus and a bit of commas. In PHP, it's just dot. It's just various things to go through. Then so once I did that, it all worked. I could take the file, the data could just go across. Then it took a little while to work out how to do the line feed, and I sort of punched it through there. And then a little while to actually go from writing to appending. And just to just get your mind around it, how it does it, you name your file that you opened. I'm opening this particular file that I'm going to write to, and so this file, and you have to tell it that this file has got a W or an A write to it, or a to it. Now what this means is that I can have a very low level device putting information out to the internet, and then my server is just on all the time. So the moment my device is plugged in, it can record information and start your experiment before you've actually uploaded your software to analyze the information. And if you can imagine, I'm using the server as a lab book, and essentially on the page it just continuously writes all the information down. Each it says the time and the value, and then what I'll do is that you can simply get that information by saying wget the name of the web page, and it just stores that web page on your computer as a file that you can go and look at. And then you can do these sorts of equivalent to having a lab book. You turn the pages over, you start writing on a new page, or you've got this latency problem. If you try and retrieve the data live, so it takes a second, half second, so but it takes a lot less if you just say in the server write a PHP file, say D, so you just run D, just wget you run it. I don't know how you'll do it, but you run d, and what run d does is copy b to e, file e, and then clears b again. So c is just your inspection file, b is the actual the storage file, and it will do that in a fraction of a second and clear that file up, and then you have the luxury to go through and use that, archive it, do whatever it is from your e-file, store it on your computer. And so what happens is that and what I'm describing is the sort of massively parallel robot labs that I built, and where the actual function was distributed, and it could self-repair. So if you can imagine that you can have several websites, several servers doing the same, sort of looking at the same data. So it's got one. So you can only write the data to one server, but then you can have multiple servers, multiple websites starting to manipulate this data, and then the data can be pulled down into your computer and analysed. All sort of pretty much live streaming, and essentially, once it's on, it just takes the data. And so that's where I'm up to. And I don't know, it's, you get this feeling that it's I don't know, just not as sharp as you used to be. And but this, the attitude of sticking with it, and so this, hopefully this podcast will go out to Peter Turner. So Peter Turner is my friend up in Newcastle, who, you know, is the person I'm most likely to ask for help. But he's always very, very busy, and it just takes time. So by the time, it takes more time to define the problem than solve it. But yeah, in the process of defining it, you. So it's really what I set out to do is actually gather data, gather data and feedback to actually precisely nudge this program. And so in both these cases, with the LCD display, where I unfortunately didn't have the brain power to work out the symmetry of the wiring. So basically it's, you know, left, and I just sort of randomly, you know, bashed my way through that one. And for this one, yeah, I suppose I know where it's going, but it's just, you know, taken hours of hack. So I'm going ahead, but not as fast as I could be. But this is using the techniques, the style and techniques that I had had before. So that's where I'm up to at the moment, and I'll continue and do one more podcast. See, thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.